The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, this is the first recording after the election. As you recall, we were recording during the election last week. And, you know, there are some things we definitely need to cover.
Not only is this a fascinating period of time now to the end of the year, but 2013 promises to be full of adventure. We've got a number of things to cover today. The election results, of course, both elections, market implications.
Let's stop at the both elections, because while we were recording last week, of course, people were going to the polls. We were recording just as they were beginning to go to the polls, but there was another election going on at that time, and the markets had already told us who was going to win.
That's right, and actually, the voting with the feet, as people were exiting the stock market, said, I think we know who's going to win, and we don't like this.
So, and gold was going up at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. We've got market implications. We'll cover that. We'll look at stagflation and some thoughts on inflation and deflation. Perhaps an interesting perspective that will shed some light on where we're at and where we're going in the gold market.
Well, and then also, Dave, I think there are so many people who not only look at the government, they're looking at the Federal Reserve and just how much power they have. You know, what does this change with the Federal Reserve? And do they have the teeth to change things if something goes wrong?
Kevin, perhaps the strangest events of the last week relate to Benghazi. And, you know, strange events now are either being uncovered or buried deep in the wake of General Petraeus' retirement. The rumors are interesting, and we'll keep our eyes and ears open. The only time, or perhaps Star Magazine will tell us if they're true, but we have either illegal CIA activity, an interrogation facility, may even have Bill Clinton working on a new biography and considering Paula Broadwell as a writer. Huh. There's a lot of strange things coming out of Washington right now.
Well, you know, it seems like we may have another gate in the making. You know, I remember being a teenager when Watergate was occurring, and that can really change the focus of an administration very quickly.
Well, we wonder at the speed of his departure. You know, a scandal.
You're talking about Petraeus.
Exactly. Yeah. Scandal may be afoot. Now, here's the thing. Sex is not a scandal. That's not scandal material in Washington, D.C.
That's nothing new in Washington.
That's nothing new in Washington, unfortunately, regardless of the general's confession. But it is scintillating enough as a headline to be an effective red herring. And that would really be the question, what are they trying to divert attention from? What really did happen in Benghazi?
Well, I think we're going to have to keep watching. But right now, David, let's go to the election results, because, you know, there are some counties we're finding out that actually had better than 100% turnout, which I just have to thank the voters for doing.
No, that's fantastic. No, and in other counties where we've had up to 100% that voted for Mr. Obama, which is fascinating because statistically it's, well, I guess it's not impossible because it did happen.
Right, I guess it did. But the popular vote, okay, let's just take things as if it was not a, you know, a controversy. The popular vote was close.
And the Electoral College was, of course, a blowout in favor of the incumbent.
Right.
Now, the second vote, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, was that of the market.
And I think it was telling.
The market is unhappy with another 4 years of Obama. You know, just in summary from last week, we said that the primary issues are still the primary issues, regardless of the victor.
It could have been Romney, Obama, but these two issues still stand in front of both of them.
And in the short term, you've got the fiscal cliff as we head towards 2013 and 14. That longer term perspective, next year, the year after, 2015, we still have the budget deficit and our looming debts and longer term liabilities. And these are issues that have to be addressed.
Okay, but yes, let's take us back to last Tuesday morning, okay? And gold was up about $30. The stock market was down. So that was the vote that was going on that was a precursor to the actual events in the election. And here's what's interesting, David. After we found the result, which of course we found out the result very quickly this time, the next few days, those markets continued to move in that direction. So they weren't wrong at that point.
Right. Well, the market response was interesting, definitely worth reflecting on. Equities were down and have been subdued since the election. Bonds up with yields, again, heading lower once again.
So that's the expectation of lower rates.
Well, not necessarily the expectation of lower rates, but maybe just the rotation out of equities and into something that represents a liquid pool.
Including gold and silver, then.
Gold and silver definitely were up. I think actually on a different basis. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
What does it mean? Well, again, there's several currents that are in effect. First, I think the most powerful man in the world got to keep his job.
Not Obama?
No. Ben Bernanke is still at the helm of the Fed, and he will continue the central bank's extraordinary monetary measures with perhaps a few variations on the theme into the next 4 years. And when he retires, I think the likely replacements are all dovish on inflation as well. So in all likelihood, we'll continue that same legacy of interventionism in the market. Janet Yellen is sort of the heir apparent and fits that description precisely.
So she likes the word infinity as well.
To infinity and beyond. Yes.
Okay, well, with that in mind then, gold and silver were up, and was that in expectation of that infinity that we're talking about?
They were up sharply on the news that monetary policies of a loose nature would be with us.
Right.
So that really, there was not so much an equity shift to gold as it was good. Ben's still in power, and we know that the money's going to be flowing, so some of your quote-unquote risk-on trades definitely caught traction. But particularly interesting was the fact that in the context of those quote-unquote risk-on trades, equities were down.
That's amazing, because if you think you're going to have unlimited stimulation of the economy and unlimited printing, how come the equities now are reacting to the downside?
Right. Well, on the one hand, you've got monetary issues, and we talked about Ben B.,
right.
On the other hand, you've got fiscal issues, and this is where, again, stocks sold off heavily, with dividend payers getting hit particularly hard in anticipation of the Treasury sucking more investment dollars into its vortex. That is specifically capital gains taxed at a higher rate, about a 60% increase, and dividends, too, they'll be taxed at a higher rate, up from the current 15% to over 43%. That's an increase of 180% from the current levels.
That's a huge, huge effect on people's stock portfolios.
Well, listen, with less reward for ownership, the risks in the market are less justified, and a number of investors are opting to harvest long-term gains ahead of January 2nd. Well, we can't blame them. I mean, it's never a good idea to stay on the side of a limited and dwindling reward when risks are becoming unquantifiable. Now, yes, we know that taxes are the known element. Those are quantifiable. But the market adjustments to a different level of taxation, that's unknown. What does it look like as the government gets more and more grabby? We don't have tax certainty. We don't have regulatory certainty. This is the same issues which were plaguing us as we came into the tail end of 2012.
So when money moves out of stocks, it has to go somewhere. And you're saying the bond market was the recipient of the benefit at that point.
Bonds moved higher in large part, because the rotation out of stocks. Because in honesty, when you have more monetization, when you have more easy money, arguably, other than the initial, say, purchase of asset-backed securities, which can distort pricing, you're really talking about something that's going to hurt bond yields and press them higher eventually.
Okay, now, can we see this as a trend? We've seen the bond market rise now for close to 30 years, but in this case, we're starting to see it again. Is this a longer-term trend, or is this something that may change?
No, I think the trends are likely to continue. The markets are voting with their feet. Now, this is perhaps controversial, but the markets are voting with their feet in recognition that the 47% got their man.
Right.
The reality is, and now we're not talking about Ben. We are talking about Mr. Obama. And the rest will be doling out a greater share to pay for the bills of others as a consequence. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, regardless of the rhetoric, taxing the wealthy isn't sufficient to fill the fiscal gap that we have.
Well, let me ask you, okay, let's say you took everything of the very wealthy. Would that take care of the issue?
You're talking about 100% tax on their income, 100% tax on their capital gains.
That would be Soros working for free.
Yeah, well, while that's an interesting idea, and I think that's actually worth thinking about,
okay.
Maybe I just like thinking about that. No, that's not enough. And along with all of the other folks that are very, very, very well-to-do, they still, if they donated 100% of their wealth, can't fill this gap.
Mm.
And we're not even talking about donating 100% of their wealth. We're just talking about income and capital gains taxes going up. So there simply aren't enough of the well-to-dos to make up the gap between tax income and spending outflow.
Well, I hear a little voice in the background saying, middle class, middle class. They're the people who are always supposedly protected, but the middle class, they're always the ones who are thrashed.
Now, the middle class will feel it most, certainly on an indirect basis, and probably on a direct basis. And I think this is where anyone who thinks otherwise is a bit politically naive, not meaning to be insulting here, but who says that the government has to keep its word?
Well, I thought they did. Didn't they give their word that they were going to protect the middle class?
And, you know, frankly, this is not a partisan issue. Republicans Republicans and Democrats, who says that government has to be consistent with what it promises and with what it does. This is the nature of politics, talking out of both sides of your mouth. Doing one thing, talking a good game on the other. You don't have to deliver on your promises. You just have to talk a good game.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting, Dave, we talked about how the market sort of knew who was going to win on Tuesday, even before the vote was counted. But the markets actually had guessed the other direction if you go back to the Friday before the election. And so what made them change, or what gave them the difference?
Well, it was interesting. The market perception of the election results was one thing on Wednesday, but the Friday before the election, the market was guessing at the opposite.
They were looking for Romney.
They were looking for a Romney victory,
yeah.
And bonds, equities, and precious metals traded in the exact opposite directions they did on Election Day.
Okay, but the markets were wrong the week before, and then they got it right on Tuesday. But let's just pretend. Let's just play a game now for a second. If Romney had been elected, I mean, why did the markets react the way they did when they thought Romney would go in?
Well, we can't live our lives in the ifs or the could have beens, but clearly a different Fed chief, promoted by a different president in the Oval Office, could have set monetary policy in a direction that complemented the necessary, the needed reforms at the level of fiscal policy.
Right. And let's again, we've done this before, but let's define the difference between fiscal and monetary, because there's a big difference. And as we go on in this conversation, I think you're going to want to focus on the fiscal. The fiscal is the government. It's the amount that the government spends. It's the amount that the government takes in revenues.
Well, and we said there were several currents in effect. This would be that second current that's in effect. We have rules which could have been applied by a new Fed chief, and we're talking about rules specifically versus the discretion that's being applied at every turn as a present leadership.
Right.
We're talking about Ben Bernanke, with results continuing as before. What is that exactly? A business community which is unable to plan its hiring and spending initiatives. I mean, that's the bottom line, is we have paralysis. We have paralysis amongst your business class, and we're talking about your leadership, the executives and managers of corporations all across the country. On the other hand, you've got risk assets that like the status quo. Because again, easy money policies promote speculation without there being any recourse.
You're talking about the shorter-term traders. The long-term investor was selling on Wednesday. They were getting out of the stock market, but traders were just loving the spread.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, what they do like is the idea that cheap and easy money will be with them in 2013.
Hmm.
Why? Well, they're playing with borrowed money. Playing with cheap money, frankly, is in the end very different than what you could call costly capital, which is money that's either been hard-won and earned or hard borrowed in terms of the cost. Again, if you're borrowing it at 7 or 8 or 9%, you care about that debt much more than you do the money that you borrowed at 0% or 1%.
Okay, so David, what you're saying is without an all clear on predictable monetary policies, the speculators are going to continue to hope for more juice.
And on the other hand, you've got business operators who will remain cautious in their commitments, favoring, unfortunately, firing over hiring.
Hmm.
And we note 45 official layoffs, some of size, which have been announced since last week's political decision. And this leads us to our main topic today, stagflation, and the progress towards an inflationary outcome, which we think is in the next several years.
All right. Well, David, if you would, please define stagflation. I think we hear it a lot of times, but what is the actual definition of stagflation?
Well, when the economy of a country is failing to grow, but prices are going up, that's a problem. That's basically where you have stagnant growth, stagnant employment, and rising prices.
That's where you run out of money before you run out of month. And so the person doesn't really understand prices are going up, but their wages are not keeping up.
And I think to reflect on this, you can look at the periods of stagflation that we had in the 70s as a useful model for the current period. 1973 to 1975 being one of those periods of stagflation, and 1978 to 1981 being the second. 73 to 75 was a time frame very much like this one in the present. The early warnings of inflation became irrelevant, and that was just from a few years earlier. In other words, inflation rates had been rising in the late 60s, about 1966 to 1969, and then actually inflation flatlined and started to drop. It dropped from 6% to back under 4% by the time you got to 1973. A recession, rising inflation rates, again, they ran in a parallel track with gold moving from under $100 to $180.
That's right. Gold almost doubled during that short period of time.
Then 75 and 76 saw a demoralizing consolidation in gold as it dropped back to 120 an ounce. By 1977, inflation was back on the rise, and gold was 2, and the rest is history, as they say.
Well, yeah, of course. Gold ran up by the time we got to 1980. We had already gone over $800 an ounce.
But, I mean, from 1976, 77, you're talking about 120 to 875.
Right.
Fairly short period of time, 24 to 36 months, to be precise.
Well, David, when I went to school for economics, I remember they talked about inflation being a problem when you have too much growth. Okay, when things are going well in an economy, you've got to really watch that inflation, and the Federal Reserve has to control that. Is that a correct perception?
Well, when you look at 73 to 75, and that second period, 1978 to 1981, these are two periods that stand in contrast to what you just said. Economists assume that inflation occurs in a growing economy, and as wages increase, which is the culprit really for driving up the cost of limited goods, this can include an increase in the money supply, which banks are supposed to be lending and households are supposed to be integrating into the economy. But in a period of stagflation, like these two periods just mentioned, quite the opposite occurs. You've got wages that are stagnant, economic growth that's stagnant, and prices nonetheless are on the rise.
Well, David, trillions of dollars have been printed recently, so I would imagine, you know, the supply of money factors into that. I know that they were printing money back during the 1970s to pay for the Vietnam War.
Absolutely. Well, and here's a different perspective. A greater issue, perhaps, than supply of the money is the demand on the currency. I mean, think about this. This is a different way of approaching it, but a far greater issue is currency demand. In other words, people want to get rid of the currency in question, and the normal pockets filled with dollars are in a certain circumstance trying to be emptied as much as possible, as quickly as possible. It's not just the quantity of money in question, but it's also the turnover of the quantity in question.
So it's a little like playing hot potato. There's a time when you don't want to hold cash.
Exactly. And who wants to hold the stuff? Well, mind you, we are a ways off from this kind of currency purge. We're not on the verge of a collapse in the dollar or a no-confidence vote. But we should keep in mind that it's not a result of policies, but rather of popular belief. There is a shift in sentiment from trust to distrust of the money itself, and, of course, distrust of the money mandarins, specifically the Fed.
Well, you know, it reminds me of a definition that someone who works here brought up one time. I thought it was brilliant. He said, you know, inflation is something that happens over time. Hyperinflation is something that happens in a moment. And there is something that changes when a person goes, oh, my gosh, my dollar might not be worth something
tomorrow. I better spend it while I can get something for it, get anything for it. Now, that's a psychological event. That's a sociological event and not an economic one. And that's why the models fail to capture it.
And that's something that cannot be controlled by any government or Federal Reserve, I would assume.
You're exactly right. The Fed can do nothing to stop that from occurring. Plosser was recently saying, we have all the excess reserves sitting in the banking system. I quote, a trillion plus in excess reserves. And as long as the excess reserves are just sitting there, they're not only the fuel for inflation, they are not actually causing inflation. If they flow out too rapidly, we will potentially face some serious inflationary pressures.
Okay, so, you know, it reminds me of a stick of dynamite. It's very benign when it's sitting on your desk. You know, it's like, okay, well, that's just a stick of dynamite. It looks like a rolled up piece of, you know, like a toilet paper roll or something.
Well, this is what
but it's potential.
And what we're talking about with turnover is something that can go from 0 to 60 very quickly. We are sitting on a six-decade low in terms of the velocity of money. And this is a somewhat esoteric idea. We've discussed it on the program before. But velocity of money is what we were just talking about, the turnover in the quantity of money. How many times does a dollar bill go through the economy? It gets spent, redeposited with a bank, lent out, spent, redeposited with a bank, lent out. How many times does it get spent? And velocity picks up when people don't want to hold on to the money because they fear it's going to be worth less tomorrow than it is today. Some economists are not concerned about inflation and the potential for these excess reserves quickly entering the larger economy because of this very point, because they look at velocity and they look at how low it is. And it is, in fact, low. Again, it's at a six-decade low.
Sure.
The weakness of that view is simply that low turnover in the existing stock of money, in looking back at what has been the case over the last 2 months, 2 years,
right,
as if the past and future already determined one on the basis of the other, this can change instantly with people's perception of the desirability of that money shifting.
Well, David, that brings us to the current Federal Reserve, which is a Keynesian approach.
Well, yeah, the current Fed doesn't link money supply or the national debt to a potential rise in inflation. They focus on some esoteric things, costs, slack, quote unquote, in the economy, slack in the economy, the expectations of inflation, which Ben has famously described as well anchored. In other words, we don't expect them to change anytime soon.
That's a perception that they like to employ, which is that they can change the perception of the people with simply just stating things.
What they're accomplishing very effectively is controlling perceptions. And the Fed is in control because we believe they're in control. Any change in expectation will be present in the bond market. That's the assumption. You're going to see the price mechanism in the bond market and yields change value as bonds reprice to reflect the real rate plus expected inflation. That's not occurring, and we're getting a good line from the Fed. Therefore, we should be very comfortable with their current monetary stance.
Well, and David, isn't there just sort of the thought process that the bond market and the interest rate markets are going to anticipate inflation early enough for the Federal Reserve to take action?
Well, I'd like to think so, but the long-term interest rates did not anticipate the inflation of the 1970s, and this current period of stagflation leading to higher rates of inflation is not likely to be anticipated either. If inflation can surprise the Fed, it can certainly surprise the bond market as well.
So you're talking a shock.
Well, and this is because both groups have put ideas in front of market realities.
And John Cochran's not the one who was in the OJ trial.
No. From the University of Chicago, he says that on occasion, events outpace ideas.
Right.
And that's the end of his quote. But leaving clean economic theorems basically scrambling to explain events that were not or could not be predicted.
Which, you know, your dad, whenever he would get up all through the years, he would explain the definition of panic. That is the definition of panic. When expectations are suddenly changed and people have to recalibrate completely.
And we see this if you look at any of your Latin American bond markets, you can see a shock to the system where what was being priced in was perfection and what they got was really hell on earth in a very, very short period of time. Arthur Laffer, this goes back to 2009 in a Wall Street Journal op-ed piece, he says, you know, the panic for money, and he's referring to the 2008 cash scramble, the panic for money has begun to and should continue to recede. Reduced demand for money combined with rapid growth in money is a surefire recipe for inflation and higher rates.
Right.
End of quote. We don't see this as imminent, but it's a near certainty in the next 4 years, this idea of reduced demand for money. We've printed it. It's sitting on bank balance sheets. They've redeposited it with the Fed. It's sitting there as excess reserves.
But it's not turning into velocity of money. And this, it's like what you've talked about before, David. It's like water being held back from a dam. Once that dam breaks, there's an awful lot of water going down the canyon.
So pick one of a dozen different issues which could change people's perception of the desirability of that money in question.
Yes, but Ben Bernanke would say, okay, so that happens. I'm going to just raise interest rates. Can he?
Right. So the idea that the Fed can raise rates when needed to fight inflation. Well, the budget deficit would explode higher, bearing the added costs of higher interest rates on the U.S. debt obligations. Interest alone, we're not talking about paying off the debt, but the interest component alone would suck the life out of the economy,
right,
gobbling up a very large percentage of national income, that is tax revenues. The debt we have, the deficits that we're running each year, they can, in fact, cause inflationary concerns. How will the deficits be paid back?
So that's what the person buying treasuries would ask. How in the world are they going to pay these deficits back?
Right. And this is where this argumentation in Washington is critical to the valuation of the U.S. bond market and the stability of the U.S. dollar. What they don't realize is they are playing with fire.
Right.
They will probably put something together between now and the end of the year. It probably won't be a long-term solution, but just kick the can into 2013 or 2014, buy a little time. Maybe it's 6 weeks, maybe it's 6 months. Maybe it's longer than that, but I would severely doubt it. They want to get past this critical juncture. They want to get past the inauguration and into the first 90 days, if you will, at least. If the payback, and again, this goes back to your point of what are the bond market, how does the bond market perceive all this? If the payback is not due to economic recovery and an increase in tax income, then how are they going to pay off their loans? How are these IOUs going to be settled? And if the question enters into the mind of the creditor, both domestic or international, money printing?
Yeah.
Is that the solution? You're going to pay off these loans with additional money printing? Again, this deals with the judgment of the market, the shifting of a perception. The fiscal and political intransigence over issues like the fiscal cliff, like our budget, like taxation over the coming years could all serve as a trigger for greater inflationary concerns taking us into what Ben Bernanke would describe as unanchored expectations.
Well, and you don't want to lose your anchor when you're in a storm, that's for sure. Now, David, I'm going to go back to John Cochran for a moment, and he talked about the value of bonds actually is directly proportional to the people who buy them realizing that you're going to be able to pay that off with a surplus. Now, that surplus could come from productivity. Ultimately, it's going to come from revenue, though. Now, if they don't see that that's going to be paid off with a surplus, and they believe that it's actually going to just be printed out, that's when you're talking the perception can change, and that can change on a dime.
Well, and this is why your major explosions of inflation throughout the world have tied to fiscal problems.
Right.
Inflationary expectations are nil when a government keeps its fiscal house in order, and they can rise very rapidly when governments show that they're mishandling their finances. Now, I think it's plain for everyone to see that this has been the case in Europe. No one was asking the question about Greek solvency in 2003 or 4 or 5, but now everyone would assume, are you crazy? They do not have their house in order. Who would lend them any amount of money?
Right.
Now, that's not the perception of the U.S. today. The question is, by the time we get to 2015, 2016, have we resolved, of course we will have resolved the fiscal cliff, but what about our other issues, the deficit? What about our long-term spending and liabilities?
Well, and David, there's the fiscal cliff. We've got, you know, you talked about 2015 getting out that far, but actually in the next couple of years, 12, 24, 36 months, we've got an awful lot of our debt coming due that we're going to have to deal with as well.
And that adds an extra layer of inflationary concern. It's built into the structure of our debt. As you say, 24 to 36 months, we've got the majority of our bonds that are coming due. It's not being tilted. Our debt structure is not being tilted towards long-term loans. What that means is that we face the continued threat of rollover, of a liquidity crunch, and the only expedient resolution being another round of monetization.
Which is printing money.
You've got the Fed purchasing IOUs with money that 2 seconds before did not exist.
All right. Now, David, there are some very, very smart people that you've had dinner with, you've gone out with, you've had meetings with, who are what we would call deflationists. What are they thinking? We're talking inflation here, or stagflation. What do the deflationists think?
I'm taking the other side of the argument. The deflationist argument runs like this. Given the total stock of debt, which some count as high as $131 trillion, a more conservative estimate might be $70 trillion. Again, this is current liabilities plus future unfunded liabilities. We're talking about a long-term balance sheet adjustment that needs to take place. It's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
We ran up the bills. Now, how much time will it take to pay them off? You know, once you move into the sort of terminal state of over-indebtedness, paying down or unwinding debt, in fact, takes a long time. So historically, the coordinated, and again, if you're trying to intentionally honor these long-term liabilities, it takes roughly 23 years to get caught up on your bills. And now, 23 years is a long time.
Right.
And the deflationists would argue, therefore, nothing will change the course of the bond market. Lower and lower rates. Therefore, greater and greater demand for dollars, the instrument used to pay back those obligations.
But that's assuming that we plan on paying back the obligations.
Well, enter the Fed into the equation as the weakest link. You're dealing not just with economic realities here. You're dealing with, over the next several months, of course, the fiscal realities, but you're dealing with psychology and you're dealing with perception, which can change depending on social mood and sort of that intangible, a commonly held belief. Today, we believe that the Fed's capable of managing our money system. Tomorrow, we may not. And this is where, again, the notion that we may find default, not as in we call our creditors and say, sorry, we're not sending you this month's payment.
Right.
But we say we're sending you this month's payment and next month's payment ahead of time. And we hope that they don't ask, where'd you come up with that money? Because in fact, if it came off the printing press, if it's hot off the printing press, they may be a little upset.
That's not a surplus. That's just printed out of thin air.
Again, credibility is something that's fairly easy to keep. But once it's lost, it's nearly impossible to regain. So, you know, the Fed's extraordinary measures, looking back over the last 3 years, we're not questioning them. They've been successful in terms of holding things together. Recovery? No. Fixing the problem? No. But largely, you look at these measures, throw them under the microscope, and the man on the street simply doesn't understand what has been happening already. If they were fully understood, if these measures over the last 3 years were fully understood, I think credibility would at least be on the table for discussion. not that full discrediting would yet have occurred, but could be sort of that feature for 2013 to 2016, that kind of a time frame. It really has to do with our creditor relationship. And if they perceive us running a hot and heavy inflation rate, in spite of the official numbers which we are lying about, if they see behind the veil and start doing what Jacques Roof told de Gaulle to do, adjust the equation. Take gold. Don't take dollars. You're at risk. They're paying you off with worthless currency. Again, that perception changes, and it's not just central banks that cause a run out of the dollar, but the demand on the street follows suit.
So there really is a difference between the quantity of money and the demand for money. I mean, there's a time when a person's going to run to cash, and they're going to want as much cash as they can have, which is what we saw in 2008, 2009. But we're seeing that change, and it could change very rapidly where a person says, oh my gosh, I'm not holding cash at all.
So on the table today are a variety of fiscal issues which have to be addressed. And if our legislators don't address them, or if they lean too heavily on the monetary mandarins to fix the problem and the Fed has to step in and start printing again, we're on the cusp. We're on the cusp of disenfranchising our creditors. And when our creditors are disenfranchised, they will begin to play a game, perhaps even a war, where we may not win. Even though we have all the tanks and bombs and guns in the world, we have a strange and unhealthy dependency in the currency realms with creditors who, frankly, have a lot of control, a lot of influence, a lot of power. And we just hope they keep their mouth shut as they fight their war, because if the man on the street, again, panics, that's where you have hyperinflation. It is a singular psychological event, not an economic one.
Well, and you know, that's when events overwhelm ideas. You know, you talk about all through history when a really good idea could not be employed because something happened. Okay, someone attacked. There was an invasion, okay, or a natural disaster.
An oil shock.
Right, or terrorist attacks these days.
Yeah, even a political shift where you just change the status quo relationship. There's so many things that could change, and I think the backdrop is perfectly set for there being what seemed like a disconnected event somehow having ripple effects into the world of finance, and this time on a very dramatic scale in terms of their outcomes.
Well, and we're talking about demand for money. You know, we've had a reserve currency in dollars for so many years, you know, through the Bretton Woods system. Yet we're starting to actually see this, Dave. We're not just talking about some sort of hypothetical theory in the future that there could be a sudden change. We're seeing dollars being converted to gold overseas right now in India, in China, in Europe. The central banks are net buyers of gold. So how does this affect gold as we talk about this?
Well, while I may not have been supportive of the Obama bid for the White House, he has been very supportive for the gold market and our business the last 4 years. He gave us the move from $820 an ounce to $1,920, about 134% move. And frankly, I think following the re-election, a quick move higher, $50, again, following the 2 days after the election, we have a preview of things to come, a preview of coming attractions, if you will. It wouldn't surprise us if the price, starting in early January and coming into the next 4 years, is up 134%. We are almost certain to see the same thing. 134% move. This man will get us there.
Over $3,000 gold is what you're talking.
If only on the basis of Ben Bernanke and Mr. Obama. If there's more to the story, then I don't know how to peg the price.
Well, David, we really shouldn't neglect just the plain old supply and demand. You know, we've had guests on over the last month that have said, look, it doesn't matter if gold goes over $3,000 an ounce. We're not going to be able to produce much more gold than we're getting right now. And the demand over the last 10 years really was not due to stagflation, hyperinflation, deflation. The demand has just been simply moving into gold, new economies and old economies moving back into gold, and the supply not keeping up with the demand.
Now, it's these policies that we're talking about, fiscal and monetary in nature, which simply get us there much quicker and perhaps to numbers that we couldn't have imagined prior to.
So this is just icing on the cake for the gold market.
You've got it.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.